Good morning and welcome to the November 25th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Kevin Kennedy, and I'll be joined by my co-host, Roger Goldman, in just a few minutes. Today on Mountain Money, we have Chantel Fernandez, co-author of Selling Sexy, Victoria's Secret, and the Unraveling of an American Icon. Next, we'll hear from Ginger Wicks and learn about Small Business Saturday. Then we'll finish our program with Peter Murray and his new business, Stardust Sustainables. All this and more this morning on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
The words Victoria's Secret conjures up images of beautiful models and seductive lingerie. The story of the rise and fall of that retail juggernaut is fully exposed in Selling Sexy, Victoria's Secret and the Unraveling of an American Icon. This is a new book by Lauren Sherman and Chantel Fernandez. We're very lucky to be joined by Fernandez this morning. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Chantel, what motivated the two of you to write this book together and how long did it take to do the research?
Lauren and I had been, you know, covering fashion for a long time with a business angle and had been reporting about Victoria's Secret struggles in 2018, 2019, 2020. It was a brand that had been so successful for decades and was faltering in a really unusual way. But we felt that there was a deeper story there. You know, often with Victoria's Secret, it is sort of the reputation as well. It has these beautiful women and it's advertising. It's not much more complicated than that. But we felt the real story was much more fascinating. How did this brand become one of the most powerful and influential retail chains in American history? And what we found was much more interesting even than we thought. And we spent about 3 or 4 years speaking to executives from all these different eras of the company and experts and consultants and sort of cultural figures to really understand how this brand came to be at its peak. Kind of a company with no significant competitors and a brand that every American has some sort of connection to, whether they shop there or not, you have some awareness of that. And there's very few brands like that in our country that reach that level.
Yeah. So let's start at the beginning. Who was Roy Raymond and how did he decide to form the company?
Yeah, Roy is the little known founder of Victoria's Secret, who with his wife started the company in 1977 in the Bay Area. And he was someone who was really entrepreneurial, you know, was always thinking about different business ideas. And before Victoria's Secret, he had the ingenious idea to start a catalog selling sex toys, which was his first foray into business. And he identified, it was sort of the same fundamental idea, which is to sort of take a taboo category and make it more accessible, make it a little more approachable. In the case of the sex toys, which he were also being sold, his wife was a physical therapist and she was using them to treat patients. So there was also this kind of medical angle on it too. But that was their first business and it worked really well. And they parlayed that success into thinking like, what's another category where we could do this? It's maybe has even more potential and we could create a store out of it. And that was how he and his wife started Victoria's Secret in the Stanford Shopping Center in 1977. It was a few stores in the Bay Area. And then from the very beginning had this catalog, which they, you know, really poured a lot of money and attention into creating these really rich images that captured people's imagination. So it had a very quickly developed a cult following outside of the San Francisco area.
We're going to talk more about the catalog and how it diverges from the retail store operation in later years. But I want to sort of talk for just a minute about the backdrop of the existing way in which women's lingerie was sold prior to Victoria's Secret. What were they sort of looking at in terms of the landscape?
Definitely. There was, to buy underwear, women's underwear, lingerie, it was really kind of divided mostly between the department stores, which dominated American retail at that time. You know, the Macy's or whatever was in your local area, Marshall Fields, Lazarus, whatever it was. or there were very upscale boutiques. And Victoria's Secret at the beginning was very upscale, but it was a little more approachable than some of those kind of European-influenced boutiques that existed in some of the major cities in the United States at that point. There was a little more welcoming to men, and, you know, Roy Raymond was already thinking about not just the catalog, there was like little fashion shows that they did. So he was already thinking, you know, bigger than just the store. But the main sort of thing he was disrupting was the department store experience, which was not a fun shopping experience. It was a bit drab. And I think that's part of what then, you know, Victoria's Secret, as it continued to grow, was really disrupting.
And we're going to talk more about glamour, but just talk a little bit about, you know, what the story behind this concept of Victoria and her secret was, and how they originally sort of tried to put this glamorous frame around the selling of underwear.
Yeah, Roy and Gay created this story, you know, fictional story around Victoria, this woman that they met on the Orient Express, who was, you know, really successful and mysterious. And they asked her what her secret was, and she said it was great lingerie. So it was a good story from the very beginning that they used to market and create a kind of more sophisticated image of the brand, especially compared to Fredericks of Hollywood, which was another chain at that time, especially in California, that people were aware of, that had a more sexual identity. And they were kind of going to say, this is a more sophisticated version of that. And part of that was Victoria and her story, and the catalog was written in her voice. And it was kind of this creating this identity around this woman who represented, I think at that time also, this idea of a woman going to work and wanting to indulge herself. You know, there was all these cultural changes happening that they were tapping into at the right time.
And the stores reflected that as well in some ways, didn't they?
Yes. So the stores, you know, they put a lot of money into decorating these beautiful stores that were Victorian influenced, antique furniture, you know, just textures everywhere, you know, just a really beautiful shopping experience that felt like a Victorian home. And that was really unusual too. And I think that is what helped this company stand out. Again, it was still just about, you know, six chains is what the six stores is what the Raymonds got it to. But each store was a very sort of indulgent experience in the way it was decorated and designed. And they were really into Victorian design, you know, in their personal at home. And so it just extended to the stores.
Now, as you mentioned, the fashion shows that they would do, did they do these at each individual store in the early days?
I think they did. Again, these were like really, you know, the kind of thing that only got written up by like the San Francisco Chronicle. But I think they did it at restaurants, different ways to sort of get the word out. Nothing compared to the Victoria's Secret shows that we now think of when we say that phrase. But there was already some showmanship happening at that time.
So they're up to six stores, and they're doing, and they've grown an interesting business. How do they end up getting involved with Lex Werner? Well, let's first take a step back. Who is Lex Werner? What was his background?
Yeah, Leslie Wexner is a super fascinating figure in the history of American retail. You know, best known in the early 80s when he first, you know, when he acquired Victoria's Secret, he was best known for having started The Limited, which some of your younger listeners may not remember, but was one of the most popular shops in the United States. And he started that in his mid-20s. He grew up in Columbus. His parents had a shop there. And he had sort of suggested, what if we, that he had identified that their business could be much more successful if they limited the amount of inventory that they had to sort of young, youth-oriented sportswear and sold cheaper items that weren't name brands, you know, put The Limited on the label. They weren't interested in doing that. He did it himself. And, you know, it wasn't an overnight success, but it was far more successful than he or anyone else anticipated. And he was also really the first person to import clothing at scale from, you know, Asia, from Hong Kong, especially at that time. And that was how he was able to capitalize quickly on trends. You know, this is a model that we're so accustomed to now, but he was really the first person to pioneer and commercialize that fast fashion model in the United States.
Yeah, I'm sorry, it's Lex Wexner. I'm so sorry. But taking a step back, you know,
it's a bit of a tongue twister.
This point you just made, okay, about the creativity that he brought to this notion of creating relationships overseas to do quick things. Can you talk a little bit about the people he did that with and how that really was sort of an underpinning of the success of the Limited?
Yes, he met this another really innovative person named Marty Trust, who had come out of the Boston area and who had worked for different manufacturers. And he was the one who first realized, oh, we could, you know, with some investment, produce really quality clothing at a lower price in places like Hong Kong or Asia, later Sri Lanka, where labor costs are lower, but you know, there's already this culture of manufacturing that's growing quickly, and we can capitalize on that. And I think in the beginning there was this hesitancy in the U.S. You know, no one was really importing clothing at that scale or at all, and you know, there's this fear about like made in China clothing that it's bad quality. And I think Les and Marty were open to the fact that people would get over that. You know, the price and the quality of the item would speak for itself. So they went into business together. Later, Wexner acquired Marty Trust's what is called a sourcing business, because he wasn't outright owning factories in Asia, but he would invest in them, have partial ownership. They would grow together. And that, we talk about this a lot in the book, even though it's years before Victoria's Secret entered Wexner's universe, because it's really important to understand the network that Wexner plugged Victoria's Secret into when he did acquire it. He already had this retail, you know, he was like a rag trade revolutionary is what they called him. This is how he was able to become, you know, a billionaire by the early 80s. It was a model that then a lot of other companies copied and was hugely influential, but had been a competitive advantage to him for a long time.
So the Limited was everywhere, and they offered this, you know, relatively good quality clothing at a low price. It wasn't all that creative, though. It wasn't, you know, sort of novel clothing. It was basically, was he basically copying other people's stuff and doing it better and cheaper?
Yes, but I would say that the way you just described it makes it sound easier than it is. You know, everyone's in that business these days.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It's difficult, but you know, with fashion and trends to anticipate what are people going to want. And he had so many stores in American malls that he could really test small capsules of clothing and say, okay, this type of khaki pant at this price is what's really going to scale nationally. So he could make very careful bets before producing a ton of, for example, that khaki pant. And that's something that's still really tricky for manufacturers today, or okay, for retailers today, I should say.
Okay, so, and by the way, the book really tells some interesting stories about, you know, his drives and his background and his relationship with Columbus and his relationship with his mother, which we could get into. But let's sort of go back to how he ends up getting an eye on Victoria's Secret. What draws him to the company and why is it there for him?
Yeah, it was in the early 80s, I think a lot of people expected Wexner to sell the Limited, to cash out. And instead, he did the opposite. He started acquiring other businesses like Lane Bryant. He launched new businesses like Express, which sort of was birthed out from the Limited for a younger, kind of more European-influenced customer, as the Limited shopper was growing older. And then a company that he looked at and correctly identified as an interesting opportunity was Victoria's Secret. And the Raymonds at that point, you know, they needed a bailout. They were on the verge of bankruptcy. You know, they had invested a lot in this business and it was making money, but they, you know, Roy was not able to sort of manage the books effectively. And perhaps having not had that experience in retail, and, you know, it's a tricky business regardless. And Wexner saw an opportunity. Here's a brand that we could take and expand across the nation. And it already has sort of a catalog list, which is really valuable. So instead of starting something from scratch, he saw an opportunity to acquire this business and really blow it out, which is what he did, even though most of his close associates advised him not to do it. But I think he saw a lot of what Wexner was doing at that time was disrupting the department store as well. You know, he was a pioneer of specialty retail, this idea that you would go to a place like, you know, the Limited or Express, and you understood what these types of clothing, the style of the clothing, who the audience was, what the vibe was through the images on the wall, a really sort of specific aesthetic. And that was something that he was sort of unbundling the department store into all these individual stores in the mall. And he saw an opportunity to do that in a really interesting way with the underwear lingerie category.
Yeah. So did Wexner seek out Raymond in particular, or did Raymond look for someone to bail him out?
I think Wexner had first reached out to Raymond. Wexner was traveling constantly at that point, looking at different stores and really aware of what was happening in the market. So it was part of his job was to be aware of, you know, what was the interesting little lingerie store in San Francisco. So he reached out first, is from what we understand from our reporting.
So, okay. So now we're continuing on. So Wexner is a disruptor of the department stores, and therefore the mall. You know, the modern mall in the 80s is the disruptor as well. How did the growth of Victoria's Secret parallel the rise of the malls that we know of now from the 80s?
It was essential. You know, the mall was the canvas for the growth of Victoria's Secret, because once Wexner acquired the business in 1982, he really was able to expand quickly in a matter of, like, you know, less than a decade. There was a Victoria's Secret in all of the best malls in the nation, where he was already a significant presence through the limited. So he had increasing real estate leverage in these malls. He was a huge partner. At one point, he was the largest tenant of America's Best Mall. So he had a lot of influence in these places and able to get good leases, good spots for his stores. So, you know, Fredericks of Hollywood, for example, which had been really popular in the 70s, had a catalog. You know, it was never a huge business, but it was trying to expand through malls as well as malls expanded in the 1980s. But Victoria's Secret sort of blocked it out, a lot of those nicer malls. And it was a way to get Victoria's Secret in front of people, because everyone would go to the mall regularly. You know, for a long time, Wexner didn't even believe in traditional advertising, because he knew the shopper was going to see the store at the mall and he could get them that way. And it was a really effective way to scale a business quickly. And that was what he was really interested in. He wanted billion-dollar-plus brands only.
And how did the sort of the book sort of suggests there were really two arms of the company that were evolving in somewhat different ways. One was the catalog business and one was the store business. How did they diverge, and what was happening to the image that the original Victoria's Secret had?
Yes, it's interesting, you know, though there's still remnants of this across retail today, but the catalog business of Victoria's Secret and the stores business were completely separate companies with different CEOs, different products that they sold in. You could not buy something in a catalog and return it in the store. These were totally separate entities with the same name and with the same corporate owner. And, you know, I think part of the reason for that was that Wexner initially was concerned. You know, he didn't have experience in the catalog business, and he didn't necessarily see it as something that he needed to continue. But, he installed really interesting executives there who turned it around and grew it. And, for example, the part of the way that the Victoria's Secret catalog grew in the later 80s and early 90s is that it started selling a lot of clothing that you would never see in the Victoria's Secret store, like jeans, sweaters, all those kinds of things. It was a huge part of the catalog business. It was a slightly different customer and a slightly different identity, but it was where a lot of this sort of fantasy of Victoria was communicated to the customer. Because even if you shopped in the stores, you were getting those catalogs at home and seeing these models and these women in these sumptuous mansions laying on satin sheets. And it was part of what drove the early idea of what the brand represented.
Gotcha. Now, we did the decade of Wexner owning it and growing it across the country, and in comes Grace Nichols. Can you tell us how she got involved?
She had come from the department store world, and I think had a friend who was working in another one of Wexner's divisions, and told her, you know, specialty retail is the future. And Grace was the head of the Victoria's Secret stores division for over a decade, primarily the 90s and into the mid 2000s, really pivotal period for Victoria's Secret, which set the foundation for the growth it would later have in the 2000s. But in the stores division, which was so much bigger than the catalogs, you know, a lot of that work around sort of, for example, a big change that happened during that period is that Victoria's Secret had sold a lot of, like, special occasion lingerie to to put it simply. And they started doing more cotton, more kind of daily stuff. And that really expanded the business, renovating the stores. You know, a lot happened during those periods. And she was one of many really talented female executives at this company in different eras that we discovered, because, you know, now that Victoria's Secret has this reputation that is run only by men, like Wexner, sort of imposing this sexist male gaze idea on America. But if you look deeper, it's not that simple. There's a lot of women who've worked at this company in different periods who saw their role as helping women kind of, you know, have a better relationship with their own sexuality and, you know, creating an interesting business. So she was really fascinating and helped that business grow in a way that was sort of unprecedented.
The role of female executives is actually a really interesting part of the book that I certainly did not see coming when I started reading it. So let's talk about a couple of things that then happened. We sort of have the concept of what we call the Angels concept and the development of those big fashion shows. Can you talk about both of those things?
Yeah, so that was a shift that started in the mid-90s and really escalated in the early 2000s, where Victoria's Secret executives are thinking about ways to keep growing the business and sort of compete more nationally. A big turning point had been the arrival of the Wonder Bra, which was a push-up bra that was not sold by Victoria's Secret, but had gained a lot of national attention. You know, women were running to the stores to buy this push-up bra. There was a push-up bra wars. There was other push-up bras in the market, and Victoria's Secret kind of missed out on that momentum. I think the lesson they took away from that is that they needed to start advertising in earnest in a way they never had before. They were just really had signs in the stores, and they needed to think bigger about that advertising message and give more of a national message. So they started doing fashion shows. They started doing national television commercials. They, you know, and then the Angels sort of came as part of that. It was like originally a television commercial to support the launch of an Angels bra style. And then it became much bigger than that. It became the sort of the symbol of the spokeswoman of the entire brand for decades to come.
And those fashion shows grew to be a huge event. Can you talk a little bit about where they peaked up? Yeah.
So the fashion show started, you know, as kind of a smaller New York City event, and as many fashion shows were at that point. But then they had the, you know, quite shrewd idea to put it on television starting in 2001. And at that point, you have to think, you know, most Americans were not watching fashion shows. They were closed industry events, probably with some esoteric clothing and scowling models. And Victoria's Secret took that format and made it a little bit more user-friendly, family-friendly, I mean, to a certain degree. But, you know, these are smiling, happy models, kind of a Miss America / kind of variety show. And it was really successful. It's like an hour-long ad that they controlled and sold advertising against. You know, it's what other brand can say that they created that kind of format for themselves? And it became an annual event that really helped create a national identity for this brand and say, you know, we represent the most beautiful women in fashion, you know, and kind of created this sort of appointment viewing.
And at which point did Ed Razzak come in?
So Ed was Wexner's sort of right-hand man in marketing and advertising. He had joined the company, I think, in 1983, working on the Limited brand, and then his role expanded over the years. So by the mid 90s, he was made sort of the head of marketing across all the portfolio of companies. And he took more interest in Victoria's Secret as it got to be more exciting with the arrival of the Angels, and they spent more money on advertising and marketing there. And it was really his idea. You know, he was a spearheading sort of this Angels idea and also the fashion show, these big sort of national initiatives to create an identity and reputation for Victoria's Secret as more than just a place to get a bra that you might need to wear on a Monday. This was a place of fantasy, and, you know, all of this helped them sell bras for, you know, $20, $30 more than you could get at Walmart. It's all about creating that sort of emotional pull with the customer that was really effective. And when he left the company finally in 2019, you know, no one had been there as long as him except for Wexner. So he was really ingrained in the culture of this place.
So we have to ask, how did Wexner come to be involved with Jeffrey Epstein?
Yes, so it's if you'd been following the Epstein story as it gained more attention in recent years, you may have heard of Wexner already. But he, you know, they met at some point in the mid-1980s, and Wexner was sort of a newly minted billionaire at that point, still living in Columbus where he lives today, but, you know, traveling more, and his business was getting more complicated. And Epstein became his financial advisor in 1991. You know, now infamously, Wexner made an unusual decision to give Epstein power of attorney. And they worked together until Epstein's like first legal issues, which came up in like 2007, when he had this plea deal around, I think it was like child prostitution in Florida. But that's when Wexner says their relationship ended. But none of this really garnered much attention until Epstein was arrested in the summer of 2019. And there was so much more attention poured into his background and who he's worked with over the years. And it became clear that he had really profited off of that relationship with Wexner. And I think Wexner's sort of legacy and reputation suffered as a result. But Wexner said he was never aware of Epstein's crimes.
Right. Now, backing up just a little bit, I'm trying to remember, was Ed Razek or was Wexner the brought about the hostile work environment?
There was a lot of reporting, really interesting reporting, and models came forward in 2019 around Ed Razek's behavior, which he has denied ever having improper relationships with models. But there were different accusations that came forward. At that point, he had already left the company. He had had a difficult, so to speak, interview that he did with Vogue at the end of 2018, at a moment when I think there was a lot more questions about Victoria's Secret's fashion shows and why hadn't they evolved. Why weren't they more diverse, you know, in terms of body shape and all of these different things? And he had sort of said that, you know, our fantasy has a narrower view, and we were always about this fantasy and we don't need to change. And I think that really soured the company's reputation. And then the Epstein stuff came out. So it was like a lot of things were happening at once, sort of reputationally for Victoria's Secret, that were pretty unusual in like 2018 and 2019. And then I think it was early 2020, again, Razek had already left the company, that there was this reporting around Razek and sort of the company culture, especially around his relationship with models.
And we sort of getting near the end of the story, at least with respect to Wexner. What causes Wexner to have to sell the company, and what's happened to the company since?
So by 2019, where there's all this pressure or speculation around his relationship with Epstein, his portfolio is Victoria's Secret and Bath & Body Works. And there had been a lot of shareholder pressure to split the two companies because Victoria's Secret was struggling and Bath & Body Works was doing really well. So Wall Street wanted to split those companies. There was an activist investor who was really agitating for that, and just to have more diversity on the board of directors and, you know, all of those things. And so that was the first thing that happened, is that the company split. And originally, Wexner was going to sell the company. He made a deal to sell it to sell Victoria's Secret to a private equity company called Sycamore, you know, a few months before the pandemic, or a few weeks before the pandemic. And that deal ultimately did not go through. So the companies were separated, and Wexner was there through that transition. He ultimately divested most of his shares of L Brands before the split. And then he retired as CEO, retired as chairman of the board. So he made an effort to step away from the business. I think the pressure from the Epstein speculation had proven to be something that wasn't going to go away, and he clearly wasn't going to like speak more about it. You know, he's spoken very, very briefly about it publicly. He wrote a letter to his foundation, and that's sort of been his main statements on the subject. But it seemed clear it was time for new leadership and at the company.
And have the new owners been able to bring the brand back, or where does it sit today?
So it's interesting to talk about sort of the rise and fall of Victoria's Secret, because it's still a $6 billion plus brand. Mm-hmm. So it's still selling a lot of stuff, maybe at cheaper prices than it was able to before. You know, it's a really promotional brand, but it still is like one of the largest sellers of lingerie in the United States, in particular with like 800 stores. It's crazy, in North America specifically. So, you know, it's it's just not, it's struggling in comparison to the high bar it's set for itself for decades. You know, their profit margins are shrinking. You know, there's issues in the company. And I think coming out of this Wexner period, they tried a bunch of different strategies, seemed like they were throwing things against the wall to see what would stick in terms of, okay, now we have much more diversity in our models, you know, all these different ideas. They just brought back the fashion show for the first time in 6 years. And it was got a lot of attention online, also a lot of criticism. So I think they're still figuring out, like, what does this brand stand for now? And how do we deal with this legacy that is both beloved and polarizing? And how do we move forward from this? But I think it's too soon to say. They have a new CEO who just joined a few months ago. And so it'll be interesting to see what the next few years hold. But it could also be a brand that just slowly contracts over time, like we've seen a lot of other sort of, you know, former glory mall brands do.
The book is Selling Sexy, Victoria's Secret and the Unraveling of an American Icon. We've had the pleasure of speaking with Chantel Fernandez this morning. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun.
We'll be right back after this. This Thursday is Thanksgiving, and everyone is focused on that and Black Friday, but this Saturday is Small Business Saturday. Here to talk about it with us is Ginger Wicks of the Historic Park City Alliance. Ginger, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Ginger, can you give us a little bit about the background of Small Business Saturday?
Yeah, well, it was originally introduced by American Express back in 2010, and it was a way to promote small businesses in the wake of the Great Recession. The annual event takes place each year between Black Friday and Cyber Monday. So for us, it's going to be November 30th.
So tell us a little bit about what the HPCA is planning around this weekend.
So we have a lot of events that will kick off on Small Business Saturday, and two of them are our holiday window contest. We have a variety of businesses that are participating. You can walk the street, view their creations within their window displays, all of which will have a QR code in the display that you can scan and cast your vote for the ones that draw your eye the best. And also we have planned at 5:30 at Miners Park on Main Street an official switch of the holiday lights on Main Street. So all the lights all above the street, the trolley, and of course the Christmas tree in Miners Park, we will all switch on at 5:30 and at a little lighting ceremony at Miners Park with Councilmember Ryan Dickey.
Now, how far up are the lights along Main?
Well, the city strings lights above Main from lamppost to lamppost, so all those will come on the Christmas tree in Miners Park, and then the city does a great job making the trolley very festive and
nice.
It'll all be lit up. Yeah, so it'll be a fun evening to be out on the street supporting small businesses.
Is the window competition a new thing, or have you guys done that in years past?
It's a new thing for me in my tenure with the HPCA. It is something that they've done previously in the past. This year, the HPCA's board created an initiative to really create vibrancy and holiday cheer on the street. This is the first step in that. Every year going forward, we hope to enhance it with more lights and decor, but this is what we're doing this year.
You know, the idea of a window competition sort of harkens back to what the big department stores used to do in the big cities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was always part of the holiday season, and you would get to really look at these displays. And I guess you're hoping that the Main Street merchants are really going to get into this, and we'll see some pretty interesting displays. Are any of them, will any of them be up earlier in the week, early this week?
They could be. The rules and the guidelines to the competition is they have to be ready to go, of course, by Saturday, November 30th. So I would imagine you'll start seeing them come to life in the next week as they begin to decorate.
And will you announce winners?
Of course. On December 14th, we're going to announce the top three.
Nice. And how many small businesses are participating so far?
So far, we have 15 businesses participating. As you mentioned, I'm hoping when they hear this interview, they're going to all scramble and want to join into the fun and festivities. It's just a great way to draw people to the street. So if you're a business, I encourage you to get behind this.
Yeah. So they have from now they have 4 days to get it together. And do you think that's enough time?
I think there's wonderfully creative people out there that could pull it together in 4 days.
Wonderful.
And what other events are being planned for both this weekend and the upcoming holiday season?
Well, as you will notice when you come out on November 30th, the snow globes are back and out on the street. This year we partnered with the Arts Council, which is amazing. So each of the interior of the snow globes has been created by a local artist. So that's really fun. You can see information about those artists on each of the respective snow globes. In addition, each artist hid item or items within their snow globe. So if you go to the HPCA website, which is historicparkcityutah.com, you can find the scavenger hunt. And you can walk the street and see if you can find all the hidden items within the snow globes this year.
Easter eggs and Christmas snow globes.
There
exactly.
you go.
Who'd have thunk it?
Exactly.
That is fabulous.
Yeah.
Cool deal. Now, so that same website is where, so when a business is listening to us right now, mm-hmm. they say, you know what? I'm going to jump in on that. And that's the website.
Historicparkcityutah.com. If you are a business on Main Street, just scroll down to the bottom and click members, and you'll see all the information there to register for the holiday window display contest.
And Ginger, how many snow globes are there this year?
There's 7 snow globes. They start at the top of Main Street, right by the top of Main Brewery, and they go all the way down to the town lift area.
And how big are they?
They're big. We call them life size because they're taller than me.
Oh. And are live people in it?
They are not live people okay. in it. Well, I don't know. I mean, you never know what the local artists have created, right?
That could be one of the hidden Easter eggs.
Exactly.
And Ginger, as we move further into the holiday season, do you have other things planned that you can share with us?
We do. So on December 7th is the annual Park City Santa Pub Crawl. That will kick off from Butcher's. That's super fun, local event to, get your holiday spirit going, holiday cheer.
It does conjure up images of Billy Bob Thornton and Bad Santa, but okay.
If you want to find out information on that event, of course, all of this is on our website. And then on the 21st, Santa Claus will make a guest appearance early coming down the town lift. So that is on Saturday the 21st at 5:00. And then on the 25th in Miners Park, we have the Grand Menorah Lighting Ceremony, and then on the 28th, we have the Menorah Parade coming down Main Street and ending at Miners Hospital.
Well, that's a big parade.
Yeah.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
And what else we got going on for the holiday with Historic Park City? Anything special going on at the Miners Hospital?
Not that I'm aware of. I would just say, again, we're trying to make it a very vibrant and holiday atmosphere for guests and locals. We encourage the locals to come up and support the businesses on Main Street.
Do we have any sense of how big an event this is financially for the businesses on Main Street, how big Small Business Saturday is?
I don't have specific data to that, and I think that's a great question. But again, I would just say, instead of sitting on your couch and shopping on Amazon, get out and support your local businesses.
Yeah, it's a lot more fun.
Okay. We've been speaking with Ginger Wicks of the Historic Park City Alliance about Small Business Saturday. Ginger, we may ask you back to find out how it went. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back after this. Many of us go to the market just to get a couple of groceries, and if we're outside of Park City limits, they want to put everything in a plastic, single-use plastic bag. And if you don't want another plastic bag in your house, you'll try almost anything to avoid that bag. Maybe you shove stuff in your coat pocket or try to carry the groceries in your arms. Peter Murray from Stardust Sustainables is with us to discuss that solution. Good morning, Peter. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Kev. It's great to be here.
Well, let's just jump right into it. What is Stardust Sustainables?
It is difficult to say, isn't it? It's a company I started about 7.5 years ago, and we make bags out of jute, and it's the most sustainable crop on earth. It's the most sustainable fiber, and we make shopping bags, and we also make beach bags.
Tell us a little bit about your journey. How did you come to want to do this, and really what made you want to start a company like this?
I think it all started years ago. I'd read a book called Halftime by Bob Buford, and he was talking about what to do with the second half of your life or your second career, and he was encouraging everybody to do something of significance that would either help your community or help the world. And so about that time is when I moved out to Park City, I'd had a landscape company in Virginia, sold that, and I wanted to do something else that would be significant. And so I started thinking about getting rid of plastic bags, and I thought that would be kind of low-hanging fruit, easy to do. And I'd read some stunning statistics about how many plastic bags there are. And let me ask you guys, like, today is Monday morning, about 9:45. Tomorrow morning, how many more plastic bags do you think there will be in the U.S.?
400,000.
2 million.
275 million in 24 hours.
Holy
That's how many
cow.
New bags.
That's slightly less than one per American inhabitant, isn't it?
Exactly. Wow. And so when I read that, I thought, you know, it's criminal that we're producing bags that quickly. So I kind of leaned on my landscape experience, and I was thinking about burlap that we use for tying up root balls of trees, and I thought, you know, well, why not make bags out of that? Because it's something it's a natural fiber, and I know it's super strong, but when you put it in the ground, it'll biodegrade.
I know you want to ask me about Jute, but I want to go back to that stunning statistic you gave us. What happens to all those bags?
Almost all of them end up in landfills. Very few of them get recycled. And there's two problems with that. One is that they're being produced on such a massive scale that, you know, even if people cared enough and wanted to recycle them, there's just not a market for that plastic.
Mm-hmm. So it can't be reused?
It could be, and some of it is, but there's not a market for most of it.
Gotcha. And do you know what natural resources, this is, it's outside of your scope, maybe, but what natural resources do they use to make those plastic bags?
It's all petroleum.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm. Sheesh. Okay, now, so you mentioned that the root balls biodegrade, and therefore your bags can biodegrade. What if you leave wet groceries in your bag for a couple of days, you forget about it, or something in there that leaks? Will it biodegrade immediately?
No, it's really no problem. You can get them wet as much as you want. You can wash them as frequently as you want. The thing that makes them biodegrade is soil microorganisms, earthworms, things like that. And so when I had started doing some experiments, I mean, that was one of the key components, is it has to biodegrade fairly quickly, but be very... You must be able to get a really long-term use out of it. And so what we're finding is that our original bags that we were making seven and a half years ago are still in use today with very heavy use. So we're saying that we think the bags will last at least 10 years, maybe even 20. But if you put them in the soil, they are totally biodegraded and they return to the soil in about 9 weeks.
Tell us a little bit more about what jute is and how, you know, the sort of the process, the life cycle process that gets them from wherever they start to wherever they end up in your bag.
Yeah, so it comes from a plant. It's called corchorus, and all of it grows in this little band between India and Bangladesh. And they actually use it as a cover crop because they'll grow rice depletes the soil nutrients, and then they use corchorus as a cover crop because it's one of the few crops that'll put nitrogen back in the soil. Then it's harvested, and the corchorus is just a tall plant with a lot of fiber in the stalk, and so they strip out all the fiber and they make it into the bags. Very, very easy process.
Where do you do this? In other words, tell us a little bit more about your process. How do you source your jute, and how does it make its journey here to Park City?
Yeah, so we had a really good contact, actually one in Bangladesh who made our original bags, and we found another contact in India who makes an even better bag, and that's who we're working with now. And I would say probably 95% of all the jute in the world comes out of Bangladesh and India. So anyway, we have them make the bags, ship them to us, and we get about half of them blank because we have a lot of customers who want custom bags printed. And as we get new customers, like this year we've added several new national parks, you know, they want something unique on their bags. And so we have to have the blanks so we can have those printed. But then some of the bags that we know we sell a lot of are very popular bags. We have some of those printed overseas.
So national parks. So if I went down to Arches, I'd be able to, or different parks.
Yeah, they're in Zion. They're in Zion National Park. They're in Grand Canyon National Park. Badlands.
And in the gift shop?
Yes, in the gift shop at the Visitor Center.
And I assume the logo of the national park is on it?
Yes.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, and they've been very, very popular. I think national parks will probably become one of our biggest clients.
Now, what is the carbon footprint of the production of the crop that makes the jute? Is it water intensive? It sounds like it adds nitrogen to the soil, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's actually a carbon negative product because when it's growing, the cortress is actually very efficient at absorbing CO2 and giving off oxygen, actually more efficient than trees and most plants. And so then when you have the fiber, you're basically taking the carbon that it has absorbed, and you're basically sequestering all that carbon in the bag for the whole life of the bag, which may be 10 years or longer. And then, at the end of its life, that carbon goes right back into the ground.
Talk to us a little bit about your distribution network. You mentioned several national parks. How do you market, and you know what kinds of outlets are you able to sell in?
Yeah, we literally started selling at the farmers market right here in town. We continue to sell at Park City Market, but it's really a matter of calling stores. And I have a business partner who joined me about 2 years ago, and we hired our first employee last year. And so that's what we all work on, is just finding new markets. And it's a lot of cold calling, but there are certain types of stores that are we have a lot of success with. Besides the national parks, REI has been very receptive, and REI has really taken on a zero bag policy this past year. And it's kind of a rolling implementation. Not all the stores are doing it at once. But we are in 35 REI stores now around the country. We just got into 3 new ones in Texas the past couple weeks. So outdoor stores and then grocery stores, especially small independent stores or small independent chains, they're very receptive. Because most of the smaller stores are community stores and they want to do something good for their community. Some of the ones that we're still trying to get into are the bigger chains, Whole Foods, Natural Grocers, and some of those. And I think we'll eventually get there. But part of it is they want to see that we've had success at the smaller level as well.
Of course, yeah. Now, is this the same, is jute the same material that they ship coffee beans in?
Yes. So that's, we call it burlap.
Okay.
And to be technical about it, okay, cortress is the plant. Jute is the fiber, burlap is the textile.
Okay, now
we we call it jute because we don't want to call it burlap, because burlap by itself is fairly coarse, and actually, to be really accurate, what we have is called JUCO. It's a jute cotton blend. We added it's 70% jute and 30% cotton.
That's done overseas, where the manufacturing is done.
Yes.
And how often do you have to go and visit the various plants and, you know, follow the sourcing to make sure that it's up to the quality that you're interested in?
Yeah, we have not been there yet, but that is our goal, to go visit. Actually, they've been out twice to visit us. They've been really impressed with the volume of bags that we're selling. And actually, they were out here last week. We got to meet with one of the owners of the plant, and they have a lot of credentials. They're very good to their employees. They really care about the environment. They've got scholarships for their employees, which are mostly women who are sewing the bags. They've got daycare and playground set up for the kids whose parents work at the plant. So it's a really great company to work with.
Yeah. Yeah.
And are they hand-sewn? You just mentioned them.
Yes.
Not machinery.
Well, it's sewn on a sewing machine.
Sewn on a sewing machine.
Yeah. Yeah. The stitching looks fantastic. Like, it's going to last easily 10 years.
Yeah. And so one of the things that I did in the beginning was, for one, we wanted a bag that would last a long time. We wanted a bag that would be super strong. And so I took, when I was testing bags, I would take them over to the mark, and I'd hang them on one of the bars, and I'd start stacking weights in it. And so we got up to 140 pounds in these bags before we could get the handles to break.
Wow, that's more than anyone would carry.
And most bags were breaking at around 30 or 40 pounds.
Gotcha, that's a good. Now, I'm going to stick with the jute and for just a moment. Are you able to upcycle, or do you know if you're able to upcycle the old coffee bags? Can you use the burlap / jute in that and then shred it and then incorporate it in with the 30% cotton and make JUCO?
I'm not sure, but that's something that we ought to look into.
Yeah, because a lot of those around.
Okay, so as you grow, talk to us a little bit about how you manage things like warehousing. I mean, if you're gonna be able to, and how quickly can you respond to a new national park, for example? So, you know what, I'm interested. How quickly can you turn around the custom logo?
Yeah, so when I started this business, I didn't know anything about international shipping. I didn't know anything about warehousing. And our first shipment went into a warehouse up near the airport. And I was led to believe that the warehousing cost was going to be a lot less than it was.
No.
And so after the first month's billing, I said, well, this isn't what you told me. So I moved it down to further, I guess, the West Jordan area. And warehoused everything there. And, of course, I've got tons of stuff in my garage. But then we started warehousing. We've got a warehouse up near Home Depot as well so that we can get to stuff really quickly. But because we get about at least half of our bags in blank, if somebody was to call me today and say, hey, I need 300 bags for an event that we're having, as long as they had some kind of artwork that was ready to go, I could have bags to them in about 3 weeks.
And do you do the silk screening here?
Yes, in Salt Lake.
Oh, good. Good. Okay, so when you get the... Now, half of them come blank, so the factory overseas will print exactly what you want if you buy a certain number.
Yes.
Interesting. Now, how many bags can you make per month, or can they provide you a month?
When we get them in, we get about 55,000 in a container. And so, you know, right now we're getting that about once every 11 months or so. But that's speeding up. So I envision that within a couple of years, we'll probably be getting or placing an order for another container probably every 2 months.
And would you anticipate having a second distribution center? Do you anticipate being able to do it all from here indefinitely?
Excellent question. Actually, we just hired a third-party logistics company, and they're up in Logan. And so our next container is going to go directly there. So we're finally going to be to the point where we don't have to physically touch the bags. Because up until now, we've physically been unloading container.
I have this vision of, you and your partner, yeah.
And so that's going to be really great because they can, when we get an order from REI in Seattle, they'll just ship directly to them. And then if probably once a month, we'll have them ship whatever, 5,000 bags or so down to our screen printer in Salt Lake.
Now, how customizable are the bags besides a logo? Can you change the size? Again, different colors?
We can get different colors of dyed jute. Mm-hmm. But right now we're getting the natural jute. Everybody loves the color of it. It's just a nice look. But if somebody wanted a large enough quantity, we can definitely get a different colored jute.
Okay. Where can people learn more about your company and how to obtain your bags?
They can go to stardust.earth, and they can look at all the bags that we have, and we do sell them online. And as a matter of fact, we have I've got a code. I think this will work for you. If I can share it.
Yeah.
It is Earth Lover. So if you were to buy some bags online and it asks for the code, put in Earth Lover, and I believe that gives you free shipping.
Okay.
Wonderful. So we've just spent the morning with Peter Murray of Stardust Sustainables. Peter, thank you for your time. Best of luck to you.
Thanks. Been great to be here, guys.
We'll be right back.